Hi, everybody. Good morning. It's really okay for there to be a little bustle here while we get settled. I'm Rick Hansen.
I'm Jan Hansen.
And we want to welcome you to this benefit workshop for the Wellspring Institute. Hey, Terry, would you just tap the space bar on my laptop there? This is my screensaver you've been watching. These are shots from NASA. There we are. Yay! So this is our official thing. So this is what we're doing here. I want to really thank you for coming. You want to sit down? I'll say a few words of introduction, and then we'll go through a little introductory material, and then Jan will take over. Then we'll have a break. We'll have a break at about 11:20, and then I'll take over to all the way to the end, where we'll have about 10, 15 minutes for Jan and me together to do a bit of a free-for-all here. Of the 10 best ways to, or 10 great ways to change your brain for the better, we've divided them half and half. Jan wanted all of them, but I held on for a few. But anyway, so we're going to do 10 physical interventions in the brain, and then, or pardon me, 5 physical interventions for the brain, and then 5 psychological interventions in the brain. All right? So that's the general thrust here. As I said, we will have a designated break, but it's really okay to get up sooner or later. That will also help prevent a mad stampede for the bathrooms when we take what will be just a 15-minute break for about 100-plus people. Okay. Let's see. Be comfortable. If the sight line's bad for you, you know, do the best you can to scooch around. If there is no air conditioning in this room, although hopefully, given that it's in the morning and we've got some cross breeze, we'll be okay, basically. If you do come to the front, watch out for our cords. This is a fairly homegrown operation here. I also want to really thank the people that have volunteered to make this work. They've just been fantastic. Everything from bringing coffee here in the morning to helping do the registration and, you know, keep us all comfortable here. Okay, so you ready to go? Ready? All right. So we will have sort of semi-designated times for questions or discussion. On the other hand, if something does makes no sense to you that we're saying, which would not surprise me at some point or other, please raise your hand so we can clarify things. Okay, so let's make sure this works. Yes. All right, here we have some introductory stuff. To create a bit of a frame, if you think about it, the 3 main places to intervene. And by the way, can you hear me okay if I stand? No?
Yes, I wanted to ask if you could raise the screen at all.
I don't know if we can.
That was its maximum extension.
I think we can't. I think we're stuck. So feel free to move. Sorry about that. What we will be doing is we will be, you know, you have the handouts for Jan's portion. And my slides, or the whole slide set, we will email to you as a PDF. So you'll have that. And we'll also post it at the wisebrain.org website, which is the Wellspring website, and we're recording this. So, you know, there will be a lot of different ways to get this information. Yeah, Terry?
Email Jan's slides along with yours.
Oh, yeah, it'll be a complete set, the whole set. You'll get the whole set. All right? So in terms of hearing me, it's not so good, so we should lean in, right? Very intimate, you know, kind of channel my inner Barack or something. Okay, good. Or whoever your favorite politico is. Okay, good. So, introductory step. If you think about it, there are 3 great places to intervene to make things better. You can intervene out there in the world where all those other difficult people are, or leaky roofs, leaky faucets, and so forth. You can intervene in your body, and you can intervene in your mind. And today we're going to really focus on the latter two, although it's important to appreciate, you know, that obviously the world makes a difference. You know, if you're worried about your job or your health insurance or getting laid off or, you know, something having to do with your child or a friend or what have you, obviously that's going to wear on you, and that's an important domain to intervene in. We just will not be addressing that ourselves. All right. So also as a frame, you know, it's a great quote here from Dogen. We'll be presenting information, but truthfully, we're kind of at the leading edge of scientific knowledge these days. What we talk about is research-based or we think very, very plausible. On the other hand, it's important to appreciate that the amount of knowledge about the brain has actually doubled in the last 20 years. In other words, people know twice as much today as they did 1990, you know about the 3 pounds of tofu inside the coconut. All right? So let's keep that in mind as we proceed.
Rick, excuse me, but did you have a handout for yours, or is there just a handout for Jane's?
We chose not to do mine because mine was long.
Okay.
So also it'll be more experiential, so it's kind of okay. So we made a judgment call there. Okay, great. Okay, so this is your brain. This is a real brain. This is not a picture. This is a cadaver, I hope. Otherwise, what a dreadful fate for that poor person. It's just kind of remarkable to look at that. It doesn't look like much, does it? It's pretty nondescript. It's gelatinous. It's not very impressive. And yet, it, right now, absent some kind of mysterious X factor, transcendental principle, is doing everything you're experiencing. The sounds, the sights, the sensations, the thoughts, the feelings, the hopes, the dreams, the memories, all of it is right there in what has been called an enchanted loom. You know, the fabric of our life, moment to moment, thread by thread, is being woven right there. You know, it's being woven right there, of course, in participation with the rest of the nervous system, other bodily systems, the world, nature, culture, and all the rest. But the primary loom, if you will, of the tapestry of the mind is right there in that image. So, some technical specs. I'm going to keep rolling here in the interest of time. So some basics. Like I said, 3 pounds, 1.1 trillion cells altogether, about 100 billion neurons. They're the gray matter cells. The brain's very busy, even though it's only about 2 to 3% of your body weight. It consumes about 20 to 25% of the metabolic supplies in your blood. In other words, the oxygen and glucose coursing through your veins. Individual neurons, here's a little schematic neuron here, are basic on-off switches, all right? And each neuron, on the average, makes about 5,000 connections called synapses with other neurons, leading to about 500 trillion synapses inside your brain. Each one of those neurons is, on the average, firing about 5 to 50 times a second. A lot of that firing is noise, kind of fertile noise, just waiting for a signal to come through. A signal basically, or usually, has to do with an increase or decrease in the firing rate of a neuron or a collection of neural assemblies. That means, though, that even with all that noise, during the space of a single breath, probably something on the order of a quadrillion or so signals moved inside your head. During a single breath. All right. As I said, there's tremendous connectivity. The brain is the most complex object known to science. More complex than an exploding star. More complex than the American economy. So that's it. Okay, so I think those are the basics, and now I'm going to turn it over to Jan, who will tell you 5 fantastic ways to change your brain for the better. Thanks.
Welcome to each other. How's that? Good. See, I'm short, so I get a little more length on that microphone. Okay, put that there. Sorry. Okay, good. All right. So I'm Jan, and I'm an acupuncturist and nutritionist. So I work with people really on the physical end of things. And so that's the part I'm going to work with. And then Rick will come back and do the whole psychosocial. I love the psychosocial. These things are so interwoven. We really can't say that we are just going to work physically or just going to work psycho-spiritually, because it all goes together. So
I'm going to get my notes.
Great.
Where did you put them?
I put them right there.
Right.
So we've been married a really long time. So get out of here, bud. You know, we just do it. So these are my 5 points. I actually have a 6th. Bonus 6, and now we're just going to move on. So my first one is really large. It actually is probably the one that will have the most difference of opinion. The next 4 slides, actually there's one other slide, but after that, 4 slides on diet. Kind of boring, We could have a lot of fights about it, but we're just going to kind of move through it because I feel like it's important to talk about it, to not just talk about putting in this little vitamin or this little amino acid without a context that the whole point is getting your body healthy, because the brain's part of the body and these things do not work separately from one another. If you feel sick, it's not good for your brain. When your brain's in trouble, usually your body doesn't feel great. So we've got to look at it broadly here. Okay, just a couple of perspectives on natural methods. So first of all, they're often really successful. I really do feel that they've been pounded out of town somewhat by the pharmaceutical industry. You know, I mean, everybody does use them now, but even if you go to your very well-intended doctor, oftentimes they'll kind of put them down, but they're incredibly successful. Many fewer side effects. I mean, you'll hear a bad thing about some vitamin, but you know, it didn't kill anybody. It, you know, I mean, maybe something funny happened from some herb, but it's very, very rare. But that said, you want to be smart about it. Many of the things I talk about, you could have a side effect from it, meaning you think it's going to do this, but it does this for you. You know, we're talking about bringing energy, but you feel frazzled on it. So you've still got to be careful with using these things. So be careful, gather information, with one exception that I'm going to very carefully talk about here. Generally, if you're using psychotropic medication, you want to be pretty careful about particularly doing the targeted thing for things for working with the neurotransmitters. Always start low. I myself am a really sensitive person, so I've really learned about the start low, go slow kind of thing. Just a comment, by the way. Do some people need a place to sit? Are your people standing are happy standing? Okay, good. Okay. If you do something and it doesn't feel good, stop. That even implies to diet. If you decide to follow my plan and it feels bad, stop. Anyway, this kind of gets in this whole cofactor thing. But also, if you're having trouble, almost all of these things can be tested. Most of them are tested by integrative practitioners. I'll tell you things on here you can test about nutrition that you can go to your normal doctor and ask for. Normal doctor being, you know, kind of a bad way to talk about them, but you know, we talk about integrative and we talk about your guy that is paid for by your HMO. So those are often two different things. Okay, so off and away onto key nutrients. What do they do? So why do we care about nutrients? They build tissue. They act as substrate in metabolic processes, meaning you've got to get from one molecule to the next. Well, basically, those molecules are made from nutrition. You know, if you didn't have your proteins and your vitamins and your minerals, you wouldn't have anything for metabolic processes. Also, another really important thing to realize about most of the things I'm going to talk about, vitamins, minerals in particular, is that they're cofactors in metabolic steps. That means molecule A is trying to get to molecule B. Almost always, it requires an enzyme. Vitamins and minerals are cofactors for these enzymes. They make the enzyme work better. So that's why they matter. You know, and in our world where we're way more stressed out and way more toxified, we need more of those than the daily value. The daily value of vitamin C keeps us from having scurvy. No one in this room is in danger of scurvy. But there are things that are slowing our bodies down metabolically, and if you get more of those cofactors in, you can make the process work a little bit better. Okay, I'm sure I'm way behind time already. All right, food. Okay, number one, this is going to be the most controversial. So protein. I think everybody needs to eat protein. We can all agree on that. I like to think of it as size of your palm of the palm of your hand, three times a day. Okay, point two, I'm a carnivore. I think there are a lot of really good reasons to be a vegetarian. The planet, the animals, I mean, there are just millions of great reasons, and I really respect them in everyone. In my world, health is not one of them. I think we evolved as hunter-gatherers, note the hunter, and our bodies were made to eat high-quality animal protein. That said, a lot of people aren't going to do it, but if you're comfortable doing it, and we're not talking about McDonald's, we're not talking about some overly fatted, you know, non-fat milk infused sausage, you know, we're talking about good quality protein. I think it's very good. Protein is the basis of, that's how we get our amino acids. Amino acids, in addition to just building tissue in that in your body, are the building blocks for all of the neurotransmitters in the brain, so we gotta have it. If you're not going to do animal protein, nuts and seeds are probably your next great option. You probably want to think about taking something like a protein powder. And if you're a vegetarian, there are a number of nutrients you need to think about. But one is to think about actually an amino acid powder. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. But that's not just a protein powder. That's a powder that's actually gotten the amino acids, which are the final breakdown product of protein, and that you're just able to take that as a supplement. It's a really great thing to think about. I test a lot of people's amino acids, and I can say that even people who are eating a lot of protein often don't digest it well enough. They still have low amino acids. And I've seen a lot of vegetarians, and they almost always have low amino acids. So something you just want to think about. Okay, the second, vegetables and fruits. We can all agree on that. Vegetables are good. What we don't agree on is actually getting them into our body. I mean, everybody knows they're good. Problem is, you got to prepare them, you know, basically. So at least several cups a day. I mean, I would go for it being in terms of, not in terms of what I actually do because I have to prepare it, but if that were the thing we ate the most of, that would be the best, I think. It would be great if it were actually the primary source of carbohydrates in your body, because they're great. Fruits and vegetables have so many things. They're so filled with all of the vitamins and minerals, cofactors, also tons of antioxidants, you know, so many wonderful nutrients that we're never going to get into a pill, as well as they have all these things that we don't even know what they are yet. You know, what Rick was saying, that we're at the limit of science at this point. A lot of the time when I'm actually studying the biochemistry around nutrition, I really feel like I'm looking at an elephant through this big of a hole. And you kind of look at trends because you read something this month and a year later, now they think something different. You know, so it's a growing thing. So no matter what you're gonna do with your nutritional supplements, eating the whole food is really important. So vegetables are really great. Fruit is really great. Fruit is really sweet. Sweet is okay. Sweet can be too much sugar. You know, very few people got into trouble on fruit if they ate it as whole fruit. But juice, dried fruit, that's pretty much sugar. So, you know, probably better to stick with the whole fruit. And, you know, fruit has been hybridized these days. It's not really what the hunter-gatherers were eating. They were eating small and sour, things that are right now for us like berries. You know, if you go to the farmer's market and you see some of those like peaches and nectarines that, you know, they have the same amount of sugar basically as a Snickers bar. Now, I think they're better for you than the Snickers bar, but, you know, they're really sugar-filled. So just think about it a little bit. Don't hold back on whole fruit, but think about it. Okay. Grains. Okay, my orientation, I'm not a big grainy. You know, I think that we're in a special group here. You know, overall, the people in this group are in Marin County. There's a consciousness. It's not average. But overall, people are so over-carbed. I mean, this world of obesity, which, you know, overweight is hitting over half the people in the country, maybe two-thirds. Most of that problem is actually not about fat. It's about carbohydrate. It's about huge quantities of grain and sugar. So anyway, I think that being a little careful on grain, when you have it, I think it's great to have it as its whole grain, meaning not ground into flour. So you're having brown rice, you're having cooked quinoa, millet, whatever, but ideally in that form. It'll just make it so that your body has to digest it before it turns it into sugar right off. Okay, and then we're going to talk more about this. I'm a big anti-allergen nut. Gluten is really showing itself to be a problem for a lot of people, particularly more sensitive people, people with more digestive issues. This is all relevant because problems in the gut, that's my next tip, you know, really do hit the brain in many very direct ways, which I'll talk about. So I'm a gluten-free person. I think that overall, when people can avoid wheat particularly and just find a substitute, they're going to feel better. But and there are many people who just can't go near it. But, you know, it's all on a spectrum. Okay, oils. So olive oil's great. Trans fats are really bad. Trans fats are partially hydrogenated or deep fried. They are just disease causers right and left. And then saturated fats. My opinion is moving on saturated fats. Actually, a year ago, I was pretty okay with saturated fat in a mindful way. I'm just more and more learning about the main fat in saturated fat is something called arachidonic acid. And it is pro-inflammatory, and it is over-excitatory to the brain. We still need it. We don't want to be zero arachidonic acid. The thing that has the highest concentration of arachidonic acid in it is breast milk. I mean, so it's a good thing, probably gooder for a little baby, but, you know, we need to have some of it. We don't want to have none. So, again, it comes with all animal product, and but we just want to be mindful of it, you know, and keep it settled down, basically. Overall, we're going to discover here that the brain, in terms of the biochemistry that I'm going to talk about, is kind of yin-yang, excitatory or inhibitory. For most of us, for most everybody in our culture, we need to get more inhibitory. We're way too hot, basically, way too excited in the brain. So, dairy, again, dairy's a big allergen. I just have worked with just so many people that when you pull them off dairy, their guts clear up, their brains clear up, their breathing clears up, their asthma clears up. I think everyone in the world should have a trial of 2 weeks off dairy. See if something changes. If it doesn't, fine. But give it a shot. See if you think more clearly. Goat and sheep, much better. And just a little note about substitutions there. So in my comment, you know, my ultimate orientation around this, in addition to the research, is that it's Paleolithic. It's what we ate as hunter-gatherers. We were hunter-gatherers for a long time before, about 10,000 years ago, agriculture came in. Until that point, we didn't have a cow that we were carrying with us. We didn't have any grain. We honestly didn't have any beans. I mean, so it was really a different way to eat. And overall, I think people do quite well on that. Okay, so this is really, if I had to make one tip, it would be really can the sugar, basically. It's not doing you any favors, and it's really not doing your brain any favor. So I list here, you know, obviously hunter-gatherers ate no sugar. Around the turn of the century, people ate about 15 pounds a year. The average American, this was a number from about 4 years ago, 158 pounds a year of sugar. Like, I know I'm not doing that, and that's an average. That means somebody's getting 300. So, you know, so the thing about sugar, as far as what we're talking about here, is it's very inflammatory. Obviously, sugar raises your blood sugar. Sugar raises your insulin then. We'll spare you all the details. Insulin is very inflammatory in the brain. Diabetes is the end state of having had too much sugar and essentially refined flour. And you look at, with diabetes, the increase for almost every disease increases, but relevant to us, Alzheimer's, depression, you know, all sorts of other things too, cardiovascular. So it'd be really great. You know, you can have it as garni, you know, little raisins on your salad, dried fruit, whatever, but not so much. The more you love sugar, the better it is to just give it up because it's an addiction. And I think as one who knows, you know, it's easier to just give it up than to negotiate with yourself each and every time you walk by the Snickers bar. Okay, so now we're going to talk about supplements briefly. So I think that there are actually four. I'll get to the fourth in the next point. But so here we'll talk about three supplements everybody should take. And these are just foundation. These, although all of them have such intricate ways that they benefit the brain. So the first is a great multivitamin. So what's in a great multi? Number one, high B's. A good multivitamin will, for most people, handle their high B complex. Hope we don't have Mr. Centrum here, but Centrum is not a good multi. Neither is Walgreens Finest. So one of the things you want to look for is you want to have those B vitamins, most of them be around 10, 7, 11, whatever, times the daily value. when something gives you 100% of the daily value of vitamin B6, forget it. It's not doing anything. Have an apple. You know, the point is that, again, we're kind of trying to flood these cofactors so that all the weird things we're breathing and the stress that are slowing those processes down can get an extra boost. B vitamins are just going out in your urine if you don't use them. There's no downside at all. They're water soluble, so no problem there. So that's one thing that they should have. A couple little notes here, again, related to mood. There was a really interesting, very recent study done where they took mildly cognitively impaired adults, I think around 60, and they did this over about a 4 or 5 year period. They did it double blind. That's like, you know, where the people don't know what they're taking, the experimenters don't know what they're taking. They gave them, some of them, pretty good doses of folic acid, B12 and B6. The others got a placebo. And after 5 years, the a subgroup, which I'll define in a second, had literally 50% less brain shrinkage than the control group. So that's a big benefit to, you know, from those vitamins. That group was a group that had something called elevated homocysteine, which is a sign of deficiency in those vitamins. So the people who didn't have elevated homocysteine, which means they had, you know, kind of what's thought of as an adequate amount, they actually had a 25% decrease in this brain shrinkage. But the ones that really needed it, it was quite dramatic for. Studies about vitamins are so hard to sift through. I mean, every now and then you get the, like the latest was, folic acid is bad. No, it's not bad. It'd be nice to take the right kind of folic acid, but folic acid is definitely not bad. So, you know, you've got to always sift through. Most of the time, for instance, vitamin studies are not done where they've tested whether people were deficient or not to start. So you're dealing with a wide array of people in a wide array of nutritional status, so you've got to kind of sort through that. Bunch of studies on folic acid and depression, low folate. Folic acid definitely predisposes people to depression, and it definitely, most of the studies with folic acid and antidepressant have been done in conjunction with the serotonin drugs. It increases their benefit about 50%, so it's quite dramatic. Okay, this, quick, yeah? That's all of the, it's a serotonin site reuptake inhibitor, and those are like all the Prozac drugs that focus pretty much on serotonin. We're definitely going to talk about serotonin in an extended way here. Okay, because it's a favorite, serotonin. You know, the drug company's got that right. Serotonin matters. Okay, but back to your multi. More boring, but still necessary. It should have the daily value of all of these little minerals. So zinc, copper, selenium, I just call them little because they're in small amounts. Calcium, magnesium, you need a bunch of it. Particularly women need 1,000 of calcium for sure. Everybody should have about 400 of magnesium. I've got some more details in later about this. And the thing about calcium and magnesium is they take so much that they take up a lot of space. You can't really get them in the multi unless you're going to take a 6-a-day multi. Most people won't do that. So get your CalMag separate and put it on your multi. Yeah?
Yeah, I heard that you should take half as much magnesium as the amount of calcium you're taking.
That's...
And so this is much lower ratio that you're mentioning. What do you think of that?
I'm being really basic here, and there are a lot of different opinions. I mean, I think magnesium is really, really great, but I think calcium is really necessary. So I just kind of gave you almost daily value-ish, but I'm happy with more magnesium. I mean, I think magnesium cofactor 300 metabolic steps in the body, pretty important. All right, so, okay, iron. Iron is another one of those wonderful things that we really need, but we don't want to have too much. So really, people should get their iron tested, particularly if you have an issue with depression or low mood. And I'm going to probably lots of times just use that word depression. And I really mean it in a very wide way. I don't mean that you just can't get out of bed in the morning, but sometimes, you know, you're just kind of in a depressive state. You're just not as perky as you'd like to be. If that's going along with some fatigue, for absolute sure, get your iron tested. The way your doctor's, the HMO dude, he's usually going to want to go for just a blood count. You can really miss it. So you want to ask them, and ask them. You got to ask them. They can do this for you. For an iron panel or a ferritin, I wrote that all down. That's why you got these notes. We're going to email them all to you, but you know, there's just a lot of data in here. You don't have to remember it right now, but you can walk in and ask. These days, with your HMO doctor, a lot of times you have to tell them what you want, and then they oftentimes will give it to you. So that's very good. Okay, so iron is a cofactor in making serotonin. It's a cofactor in making dopamine and norepinephrine. I've seen people low in iron who are clearly low in those things. They have a miraculous benefit from getting their iron up, but not too much. So I'll get you one sec, promise. Carnivorous men usually have plenty of iron. They're not throwing it off every month. Menstruating women or women who have been around having babies, they need to get their iron checked. Is there a question back there? Yeah. So there are a number of different numbers, so I'm not going to go over them all, but like, you know, ferritin, like they would allow a 15, maybe 25 you'd like to get up to, maybe higher. Again, you don't want to be too high, but on the iron, again, when you see norms, you don't want to be just like if the lowest number is 15 allowable, you don't really want to be 16, you know, and I just had somebody tell me the other day, oh, my doctor said my iron was normal. It's just slightly under. I thought, no, man, that's not normal at all. So anyway, I want to see that. Okay.
Is there any difference when you supply these vitamins? Is there any difference between paying a lot for them, i.e. buying them at Whole Foods versus buying them at Walgreens? Is there any difference in the quality as long as the weight is the same?
I would say a lot of the time there is. Now, unfortunately, some of the time there isn't. And within the non-Walgreens vitamins, there are some that are not so expensive that are just as good as some that are very expensive. So it's a really hard question to answer. People often bring me their Walgreens or their Costco or whatever. And what I notice about these is that almost always the poorer forms, meaning the less absorbable forms are in there, they're cheaper. Minerals all over the place. I mean, forms that are just so hard to absorb. Calcium carbonate, magnesium oxide, these are really common forms, very hard to absorb. So it does matter some. That said, there are companies, for instance, a little whisper here, Jarrow, J-A-R-R-O-W. Whoa, what a beautiful price point quality overlap. Not always, maybe 10% of their products I don't like, but boy, they're amazing. So, but I do think it matters, you know? So it's not just a throwaway, unfortunately. Okay. Now. Okay, fatty acids. We start to really get to the brain here. So supplement essential fatty acids. I mean, there are a lot of essential fatty acids. You've heard of omega-3s and omega-6s. Omega-6s are in all of our oils that we eat, meaning safflower and all those kind of things. Not in olive oil, by the way, which is why I like olive oil. It's a very neutral oil. One of the problems that has happened with us since we were hunter-gatherers, hunter-gatherers had like a 1-to-1 ratio of omega-6 to omega-3, omega-3 being really good for the brain. Now we have, average American, 10-to-1 omega-6 to omega-3. That's not so good. So again, after our multivitamin, I think everyone needs to supplement with fish oil or a fish oil substitute, which I'll tell you what it is if you're not a vegetarian. If you're a vegetarian and you're willing to make one concession, fish oil is it. I'd rather have you have fish oil than a steak or a piece of fish or anything like that because it's so important. Fish oil, the oils in fish oil are anti-inflammatory and they're inhibitory. This is like the cooler for the brain. You know, they're just really wonderful. Like arachidonic acid, stimulating, fish oil, cooling. You know, yin yang, hot, cold. Yes?
The fish oil is the omega-6?
Omega-3.
Omega-3.
Right, and actually, as we'll see in the slide, the omega-3s are broken into DHA and EPA. I'll spare you the long names. They having more of them correlates with less depression. A lot of studies on this. Another little thing to say about this, it may be preventive in terms of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. You see lots of studies where they took people who are deep into Alzheimer's and gave them fish oil or gave them whatever. And guess what? It doesn't work at that point. But if you look at people who have been eating this over time and consuming it, you get benefit in terms of prevention. Question back there?
Thoughts on flaxseed oil or hemp oil?
Well, the thing is that flaxseed and hemp are the mother oil, basically, that in a miracle human would convert down to the fish oil long chain EPA, DHA. EPA and DHA are not in flax oil. It used to be thought that people can convert. Now it's clear that maybe 10-20% of people have all of the, you know, biochemistry available to really convert. So that's why I say fish oil if you can. If you can't, flax oil. You can get DHA from an algae source. I do not know of any way to get the EPA from a non-fish source. So I would just feed it at the top with the flax oil and feed it at the bottom with the DHA. But you kind of miss out on a little thing there, but it's definitely better than nothing. So, okay, yeah.
Any thoughts on pharmaceutical fish oil, specifically something called Movenza?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's fine. I think that it's another new crack up happening, that the pharmaceutical companies are, you know, taking some of the vitamins and making them into pharmaceuticals. I have a patient who's taking them. His insurance pays $300 a month for what I could give him for $42, exact same. And but he's happy because he pays nothing, you know? So it's just crazy. That's what I think. No problem. Yeah.
What do you know about coconut oil? And I've heard that it's bad to cook olive oil.
Yeah, olive oil getting really hot and smoking is oxidizing, whereas coconut oil is not. I think coconut oil is fine. It is a saturated fat, but it's a vegetable saturated fat. Again, populations that are using coconut oil all the time do not have a lot of cardiovascular disease. I'm going to flip forward. I can see I'm drooping time-wise. What you're looking for is 500 milligrams each of the EPA and DHA. You look at the back of the bottle. You don't care if it says it's 1,000 milligrams or 2,000 milligrams on the front. That doesn't matter. How much EPA and DHA is in it? You want a highly purified oil. That's a big issue with fish oil. And also, always note the serving size. Have people come in all the time, bring me their vitamins, serving size 6, they're taking 1. So you just want to know, if the serving size is 2, that's what you're going to have to eat to get those dosages. There are some more chairs back there if you want to pull one out or whatever. I don't want anybody to have to stand up, but if you like standing, that's good. Okay, our last of our three vitamins is vitamin D. Very few multivitamins have enough vitamin D. As you've probably all heard, vitamin D is the new fish oil, meaning it is the vitamin of everybody needs it. We need it because we're inside and we're wearing sunscreen. Sunscreen SPF 6 blocks your ability to make vitamin D. Otherwise, you would make it in your skin. Most people would. I see people who are out in the sun all the time and they have low vitamin D and there's just something about their fat metabolism or not making it. So real quickly, again, second to last point, the best thing here is to get tested. Vitamin D is something that theoretically you could get too much of. I think it's honestly pretty hard unless you really are taking massive doses orally. Our goal is maybe 50 to 60 nanograms per milliliter. The lab test will tell you that about 30 is okay. 50 to 60 is still kind of conservative. Some people are getting really out there in the 80s and 90s, but I don't think we have any biological precedent for that. So. This is something your regular HMO doctor, Kaiser, will do this test for you anytime you ask. Because you know why? They know they're going to save a lot of money in your future health care. They love vitamin D. Kaiser loves vitamin D, so it's really great. This is one, you want vitamin D3, which I didn't write down here, but you can get it at Walgreens. Doesn't matter. You don't have to buy expensive vitamin D, and usually it's cheap anyway. If you're not going to do a test, you know, Andrew Weil says, I don't love Andrew Weil, but he's pretty good in a lot of ways. But I think, too, probably 2,000 I use a day would probably be, if I had to close my eyes and give everybody in the country something, that's what I'd do. So maybe not right for you. Okay, that's all. We're done with that. Okay. So just a little comment about supplements. Almost everything that I have talked about and that I will talk about you can get in the health food store. I do, of course, have a website that does cross-sell supplements. That's not what I'm here to do with you today. But if you want to look at my list of supplements, and obviously you can buy them there, but also you can just look at like my multivitamin that I love twice daily and look at what the ingredients in that are. And you can compare it to something that maybe you can get more easily or something that you're already taking and just see where it's at. It's a good comparison. Okay, number two, get the gut right. I actually have an article now that's going to get printed in the famous Wise Brain Bulletin. It'll come out over the next week, we hope. The famous Wise Brain Bulletin. And this is all about the gut and the brain. And, you know, in my practice for a long time, I saw how if you worked with the gut, you often got unbelievable effects on the brain. And I've always been a gut person. I had a bunch of gut problems myself that made me feel miserable. And as they got better, I got better. So I've been working on this for a long time, and a lot with kids you see it. I mean, kids are easy. The thing about kids is they don't have that much wrong with them. I mean, actually, that's kind of a lie. A lot of them these days have a lot wrong with them. But you know, when you change the diet, you can see dramatic things because they're not so complex, basically. And, you know, getting the gut right just does so many good things.
And when you talk about the gut, do you mean the large and small intestines, the whole colon, or are you talking about the stomach?
I would go pretty much all of it, but pretty much from the stomach to the end is where I'm focusing myself right now. Yeah, definitely includes the colon. Absolutely. Lots of trouble in the colon. Okay, my favorite line, the road to health is paved with good intestines. Okay. All right. So like I said, the GI tract has a lot of effect on our brain. And the incredible thing is that, you know, there are a lot of things that affect our brain. Your husband yelling at you. You know, toxins in the air, you know, just all sorts of things. But we can really change our gut. You know, I mean, people have digestive problems. They call me, oh, gosh, do you really think you can help? It's like, yeah, it's actually not that hard to really improve the gut. You maybe have to change a few things, like remove some of the foods you like. But very easy to make a huge difference here. Okay, so the most interesting thing to me lately is the way that the gut affects the brain through the immune system. So if something's happening in the gut that's not happy, and I'm going to focus on primarily imbalance of flora in the gut, so that's the bacteria, or food allergies. Also could be that your digestion is terrible, you don't have enough hydrochloric acid and enzymes, and so you're getting kind of undigested food in there, it's fermenting. But when you irritate the gut enough that it's going to start to make an immune response, in the gut it's going to generate some nice white cells, but they are going to start a cascade of a kind of molecule, you can use this with your kids later, show them how smart you are, called a cytokine. Cytokines are messengers in the body, and these cytokines will start to pour out. Most of them are inflammatory. There are some that are anti-inflammatory. They're going to go throughout your body, and they're going to go to your brain. So, interestingly enough, what happens when they get to the brain? Well, they do many, many things. I'm sure many things that I don't know and that we don't know about because we've only got this hole on the elephant. But one thing that they do is that through activating a particular enzyme that is activated with these inflammatory cytokines, they basically take tryptophan, we're going to learn more about this, and instead of letting it go down the pathway to serotonin, they kidnap it and take it down a pathway to toxins that are inflammatory. And so there's a huge now study in psychiatry that is about inflammation and depression, and atypical depression. And it's all looking at how inflammation is the cause of depression. And one of the mechanisms of this, undoubtedly, is what's happening to tryptophan in the brain, that it's getting kidnapped. So that's number one. So number two is that it also, these different ones of these cytokines, but they go in and they upregulate the stress pathway in the brain, which is called the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal pathway, HPA axis. And when that gets upregulated, then you have more stress and more stress chemistry. You feel more stressed. A lot of association with that stress chemistry and depression. By the way, with everything else too, I mean, people always come to me and they go, I think it's stress. You know, it's like, but stress makes everything worse because it's just the body on fire, you know, and who loves stress, but we all have it.
And HPA stands for what again?
Hypothalamus pituitary, and usually it's, we just put those there, but usually it's HPA. People talk about the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. It's a big word and kind of a big deal in terms of overall health. So, the second thing that happens when the gut is irritated is that absorption is really impaired. Actually, two things happen. Part of it is that more things get through the intestine. We're not really going to talk about that right now, things that aren't broken down. But a lot, there's malabsorption. And again, with the kind of testing I do, I see this all the time. The kind of things I see malabsorb when people have irritated guts, amino acids, number one. All these people who are eating, you know, their animal protein three times a day, hopefully chewing it well. That's a big key here. Chew, chew, chew. You want it to be gruel in your mouth before you swallow. Who does that? No one. My husband, but no one else. Right. That's why he's still healthy. Chews his food. Okay. So, but I see amino acids low so often. Iron low. Folic acid low. Fats malabsorbed. Question back.
How do you test for amino acids?
Basically, it's a blood test. Again, this is something that generally your HMO doctor does not do. This is more your integrative practitioner. It's a common thing. I always recommend doing it in blood. Some people are doing it in urine, just not as good. So,
within the blood, is it the plasma?
Plasma. Yep. Plasma. AM fasting. In the morning, fasting. Yeah. And, you know, is that perfect? No. But it's very standardized. It tends to be stable over days. So, you know, unless you did something really wacky, it's really not going to be different on Friday than it was on Tuesday. So it's a good place to do it, basically. Okay, so we need these nutrients for brain, so it's worth it to take care of our little digestive tracts. Okay, so what can we do? So first of all, some people who have brain issues also have bowel issues. I've seen people who have no bowel issues that come in, they don't even fart, you know? And they have, upon testing, they have terrible food allergies. You know, my own daughter, don't tell her I said this, is one of them. Never a GI symptom, all sorts of other stuff. But, you know, I didn't test her for years, and I finally tested her, and she was like in my hall of fame, as I call it. You don't want to be in my hall of fame. So anyway, of, you know, gluten allergy and all the rest, and it just was not showing up in her gut. But mostly, you know, it'll show up a little bit in your digestion as far as that goes. So one thing is that you can do is to increase the beneficial bacteria in your gut. And this is pretty easy to do. There are trillions. Actually, I was thinking there are more bacteria in the gut than there are brain cells, I believe. There may not be more than there are synaptic connections, but there are just really trillions, and people argue about it all the time. Rick and I will duke it out later. Which is more, synapses or bacteria? I don't know. Okay. All right. So they do lots of good things. They make vitamins. They protect the intestinal wall. They're very good. The other thing is that we've got some bad guys in the gut, too. And the more good guys we have, the less likely that the bad actors are going to be able to really get some space in there. So what can we do? We do two things. The easy ones, see, taking pills turns out to be easy. People come to me and they go, do I have to take the pills? I go, you got to take the pills or change your diet. Okay, I take the pills. Okay, so beneficial bacteria. There are lots of different beneficial bacteria. Quite a number of them have quite a lot of data on them. The two with the most data, this of course doesn't really mean they're the best, but they have tons of data, and good data, and they are really great. Lactobacillus GG, which is called Culturelle, and Saccharomyces boulardii. One brand of Saccharomyces boulardii is called Florastor. You can get both of those at Rite Aid. I saw them, I was in Rite Aid last night, went, yep, Culturelle, Florastor, right there. Great to take. Just one thing I'll tell you, most beneficial bacteria, you take them, you're just gonna feel better. Florastor is kind of an aggressive, it's actually a yeast, it's a beneficial yeast, but it can kill a lot of bad guys, so sometimes people will take it and feel a little bit off for a few days, And so just kind of start low, go slow. If you feel off for a couple days, don't worry about it, you know, unless you feel really bad and then slow down. But they're very, very good. And these are actually a couple things that you can take. Nothing's going to prevent everything, but like if you're traveling to Mexico or something and you want to get some prevention going, these are good things to take. Is there a question back there?
Yeah, what would be a food source?
So I don't love dairy, but obviously these come in yogurt. Fermented foods, sauerkraut. I've never really done it, but that mushroom thing, somebody tell me. Kombucha, right, that's supposed to be just filled with them. But I think a pill's really easy. I mean, again, you start to get into the complexity of these things, and sometimes a pill's really easy. Then bifidus is a really important one, particularly for kids. Bifidus is really the majority player in terms of beneficial bacteria when you're young. Also, people that have bowel problems that kind of started when they were kids because they took tons of antibiotics for their ear infections or whatever when they were really young, probably good to do some really good time with a probiotic that has some good bifidus in it. And then I listed a few others. A lot of times you'll get these things in a mix, and that's great. And, you know, you can just hunt around, go to the lady at the health food store, take my list, say, you know, what's got these things in it? And they'll help you. Okay. Now, I've got to tell you, diet really matters here. Sugar is bad. Bad players love sugar. You know, basically, good guys, I'm going to get to you definitely, good guys like fiber, they like vegetables. So you can change so much your flora by changing diet, particularly in that sugar zone. Somebody, I'll take that one there.
I have heard that all of these kind of get killed in your stomach acid.
Yeah, they don't.
No.
No, I mean, some of them get killed. A lot of them are actually really resistant to stomach acid. Some of them, like one of the interesting things about the Saccharomyces, is because it's a yeast, it'll live there when you're taking antibiotics. And, you know, our guts are actually more resistant than I'd like to think. I mean, those trillions of bacteria, they do hang in there. For most people, if we were eating paleolithically and we still had to take that one course of antibiotics, we'd be fine. But if we're eating what we're eating and then we're doing antibiotics for acne for 7 years, you know, that's another story. That definitely chugs it around here. Okay, one more question, then I'm going
to... Yeah, just going back to the fiber. If you're drinking raw vegetable
okay, so you're putting the pulp back into your juice.
The whole thing.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Is that a bad idea if you have malabsorption issues or your GI tract is inflamed?
No. You know, fiber's a really interesting thing when you're talking about like that. It's a good idea, but some people who have really inflamed bowels will be irritated by fiber, particularly what many of us would think of as the really good fibers, like, say, grinding flaxseed, which is a phenomenal fiber for some people. But if you've got a lot of digestive problems, sometimes that can just feel terrible. So honestly, some of the really cheapo Citracell, Metamucil things, for some people, is about all they can handle. But I think vegetable fiber should be okay. But, you know, the bottom line is, how do you feel before and how do you feel after your vegetable juice? If you're more bloaty, more gassy afterwards, you know, work with it a little bit. Maybe you'd be good for doing a juice, like, I'm not into fruit juice, but vegetable juice, fresh squeezed, great, man. You're just power punching it. That's okay.
You're making a distinction between juices and purees and saying
right.
You want puree, you want fiber
yeah.
content, you want
yeah.
the whole
exactly.
Not just the skimmed off.
Right. She's talking about exactly Vitamix, so it's basically a puree.
Okay.
And, you know, so you're getting a lot of fiber there. Juice, you get none.
As opposed to getting the Jamba juice and getting the carrot juice, and
right.
3/4 of the volume is going up to shoot.
Exactly. Exactly. Jamba juice, by the way, big mistake. If you're at the intersection, you know how Jamba juice is always next to Starbucks, and you say, I want to have something healthy today, go to Starbucks.
Really?
Well, if you're going to have the carrot juice, no. But if you're going to have the Jamba juice, 100 grams of sugar, folks, half of which is added in their secret packet. So, oh my heavens.
So it's more about
scary.
The sugar content.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
That's my next important question. Mm-hmm. Where does regular caffeine use come in, and what does it do bad for you, and how to get around it?
And how to get around it. All right. A man after my own heart. How to get around it. Okay. Well, first of all, you know, again, that's going to be individual. You know, the truth is I don't know exactly the way caffeine works, but one nutritionist, and I'll tell you, I think she was obviously a coffee head because she had to find a reason. She said, no, it doesn't really up your cortisol. It just conserves your cortisol. So I was like, okay, whatever, you know. But a cup of coffee in the morning is not the first thing I take people off. Matter of fact, unless they're really, or they can't sleep or whatever, I'm okay with that. I mean, honestly, maybe that's wrong. Partly, I gotta put my battles where I put them. Most of the studies are not problematic on coffee in terms of studies. Little issue with maybe elevating homocysteine. So that's the one that you gotta take your B12, B6, and folic acid for. Often my battle is more with what are you putting in the coffee, a bunch of milk or sugar or whatever. Actually, there's a Wise Brain Bulletin article on called Your Brain on Starbucks, so you can read my whole trip on coffee. So, okay.
Does it have any implications as far as the GI tract?
Absolutely. I mean, the bottom line is that if you have a stomach thing, it's going to at least be irritating. And a lot of stomach problems, reflux and all that, a lot of that is not that we have too much acid, it's that the lower esophageal sphincter, that's the sphincter between the esophagus and the stomach, is not functioning right. Coffee is definitely an irritant to that valve. I'm sorry to tell you that chocolate is also. I've just recently given up my chocolate for that reason. I am a very sad girl.
Because of the caffeine?
No. Actually, chocolate has very little caffeine, but it's very stimulating for another reason. No, I don't know what about it makes it irritating to that poor valve, but it is. And if anybody would find a workaround for me, I'd love it. Okay, last question. Carol.
Red wine.
Oh yeah, just random questions here. Red wine. Okay, that's right. Again, you know, that one drink in the evening is not my first thing. Beer's got a lot of gluten in it, so I'm anti that. People who have what I'm going to talk about next, you know, like a lot of overgrowth of yeast, will often have a hard time with wine because wine's a fermented product. You know, if you're okay, if you feel fine after it, I think it's probably okay, a glass. One thing I'll tell you about wine, this is kind of a sad thing, is that alcohol in general is really implicated in breast cancer. It really is. So is sugar, by the way. I mean, I'll tell you, we're going to get to this later, bioidentical estrogen transdermal, oh man, it's like almost nothing. Sugar, wow. You know, high insulin, I'm talking like doubling your risk, you know, it's huge. But there's like some subtypes of breast cancer that are bad guys, that even a single glass of alcohol a day almost doubles your risk. That's not broadly, but it's definitely a player. So be careful, particularly if you have other risk factors. Okay, last question.
Can you talk about soy?
Oh, soy. Oh, soy.
Might as well get it out of the way.
Might as well get it out of the way. So soy, the thing is, soy is my number three allergen, you know, gluten, dairy, soy. So whatever else we think about soy, particularly soy milk, I think soy is a spectrum food. I think fermented soy is one thing. I think tofu is another. I think soy milk, God knows what they did to get it in that carton. You know, I just see a lot of people have trouble with it. Just experiment. Go off your soy for a few days. See if your digestive tract settles down. Hard to test for it. None of my tests show it up. I have people that can't take a sip without calamity.
And estrogen production from soy?
Yeah. I mean, there's benefit there. And benefit from isolating the particular isoflavonoids from it. So there's benefit there as far as like settling down things like hot flashes. It's a weak estrogen stimulant. It's not like estrogen, but it stimulates the estrogen receptor a little bit. So, okay, we got to move on though. We're going to hit some of these things along the line. All right. So, add beneficial bacteria, decrease bad guys. So, which is to say pathogenic microbes. So these live in several different forms: parasites, yeast overgrowth, and bacterial overgrowth. Parasites are foreign invaders. They're not natural to our guts. Some bacteria are that. But yeast and most of bacterial problems are things that commonly grow in the intestine but have overgrown, basically. We've just got too much. It's like if you talk to a doctor about yeast, they'll say, oh, everybody has yeast. Yeah, everybody has cholesterol too, but you don't want to have too much. It's like a lawn. They all have crabgrass, but you don't go out with a magnifying glass looking for the single little piece of crabgrass. But when the lawn starts to die and the crabgrass takes over, that's a problem. So by getting the good bacteria up, that's going to help this a lot. Some, if you have a juicy bowel problem,
juicy,
you know, if you have, you know, again, we're talking about brain, but if you have brain issues and you have big irritable bowel, or you went to India 10 years ago and you've never felt well since, you know, or whatever, in these situations, you probably need to do some testing. And again, this is kind of more integrative medicine area. If you go to Kaiser to have a stool test, it is probably going to look just fine. They're going to find nothing. But there's very good testing available right now to find out what actually is living in there. My favorite is a lab that uses DNA to identify and quantify all of this. I think it's just fantastic, very accurate. And again, there are just many, many practitioners around who are using these things. But again, if you've cleaned up your diet like we're going to talk about in a minute, you have got your probiotics and there's still a lot of trouble, probably need to do a little test. Okay. All right. And then you treat them as appropriate. Almost everything can be treated with natural products, but parasites almost always require drugs. Okay. Food allergens. We've kind of already alluded to this, so I'm going to go real quick. Basically, the big allergens are gluten, which I listed what gluten is in, dairy, cow usually being the worst. I didn't put it here, but since you mentioned it, soy is number three. Again, it's one of those things, there's no downside to experimenting with this. And, you know, one thing you can do, again, if you're feeling low energy, a little bit of brain stuff, along with a little bit of GI stuff, just try 10 days off dairy and gluten. I mean, anybody can do 10 days. Just see how you feel, basically. If you don't notice any difference, okay. But if you notice some difference, then what you can do is day 11, you can have a party. You know, have a dairy and gluten party. See how you feel after that. You know, it's just a good way to do it. You can test for these things, you know, IgG antibody test. But, you know, you can also experiment.
Should you do one of those at a time so you
You could, but I'll tell you what, the sad, sad truth is that a lot of people have problems with both of them. And as someone said, if you're sitting on two tacks, removing one doesn't necessarily make you feel 50% better. So it might not be clear, is the point. So you decide. If you can do dairy, and then if that's not definitive, you can add gluten to it, that's probably a great way to go. Okay. You guys, you question askers. Okay.
Where does rice milk fit into all this?
Rice milk is good.
It is.
Okay. Yeah?
Is an IgG reaction
as bad as an IgE reaction? No. Well, it's bad. It's different. IgG is slow acting. When you go get skin testing, they're going to test for fast acting antibodies. And again, your mainstream doctor, he's thinking you only have an allergy if you're getting anaphylactic shock or hives after eating a food. He doesn't really care about these things. And so in deference to them, we call these food sensitivities instead of food allergies. But really, they're an allergy. It's an antibody. You know, but it's slow acting. And that's why people say, well, I don't feel bad after I had milk. Well, yeah, but you have it every day or twice a day. And so it never settles down. So that's why you have to pull off it for a week or a week and a half before you're going to feel anything. Okay.
And almond milk?
Almond milk is good. Okay. Done with all of this. All right, let's talk about our juicy molecule, serotonin. Okay, serotonin, okay, so a little talk here. Neurotransmitters in general, like I said before, we're either stimulating or settling down. Stimulating is nice. Can give you focus, can give you attention, can maybe help your memory. Overall, we need to cool out, basically. Who of us feels completely relaxed when life is stressful? Okay. All of you, you work on stimulation. Okay. So the inhibitory ones we're going to talk about, there are actually a lot of neurotransmitters we're not going to even whisper about today. But serotonin and GABA. Excitatory, and honestly, some of these have overlap. Norepinephrine. Dopamine can be inhibitory in certain areas of the brain, but we're just going to call it this for the moment. Acetylcholine and glutamic acid. Don't worry about them. We'll get to them all. Okay, back to our friendly neuron. Receiving all sorts of input, then sending a message. in the synapse, this is how the message gets sent. So basically what we're going to talk about here mostly is those little vesicles. They get filled with a neurotransmitter. So it's an electrical conduction down the nerve cell, but for it to jump from one nerve to the next, it's a little packet of neurotransmitter. Just to say, then what happens, this little neurotransmitter goes out into the synapse, and it hangs around, and then it gets reuptaked by the original neuron, basically. So that's how it works. And okay, goes down the cell, then it shoots out the little packet of, in this case, serotonin, hangs around in the synapse, that's the area between one cell and the next. It's stimulating and binding to receptors on the other cell. That's how it's doing its job. And eventually it either degrades or in most cases gets taken up by the original neuron sending the message. So now the drugs, Prozac, etc., they prevent the reuptake. So it's hanging around longer in the synapse. We're not really making more serotonin. It's hanging around longer, so it's doing more action, basically. Okay. So serotonin is the key transmitter, neurotransmitter for happy and relaxed. It is just very regulating. I mean, overall, the truth is you can get too much serotonin, but for most of us, serotonin is good. It helps with everything. And when you really get down to looking at the biochemistry of it, it's an amazing thing. It can basically control almost all of the negative effects of so many other neurotransmitters. It helps increase GABA, and also, so GABA is the other calming inhibitory neurotransmitter, and can also help decrease overactive norepinephrine, dopamine, adrenaline, cortisol, and actually glutamic acid. We know about serotonin because, like I said, the drug companies got it right. All those drugs are great for depression and anxiety. They have a lot of problems for people with them, too. And a lot of people have side effects from them. My personal feeling is if our only choice was real depression or an SSRI drug, so we didn't have any other options, I would vote for the SSRI drug because I think depression is a real bummer. Not only does it really wreck your life, but it also is very bad for the rest of your body. So, you know, now there are definitely some problems with those medications, and one of the big problems is trying to get off some of them. But, okay, this is how we make it. So we start with tryptophan. Tryptophan's the amino acid. With iron, it will convert into 5-hydroxytryptophan, which is also called 5-HTP. Then, presuming we have enough, vitamin B6 in a form called P5P, you're getting the slide, you don't have to worry about it. It will convert into serotonin, but it's good to kind of know this. If you're going to take some of these supplements, what are they doing, you know? And then a couple steps later, that serotonin will give you some melatonin. Serotonin is really helpful for sleep. Having serotonin doesn't mean you're going to go to sleep, but it enables the machinery of sleep. Okay, so what's great about serotonin is it's so easy to fix naturally. Like, really, we don't need the medication for the most part. Some people do. There are certain things you could get that you can't get from increasing the precursors. Now, see, this is different. What we're going to do here is we're going to make more molecules of serotonin. And one of the interesting things on this pathway in the body is that there's not a feedback loop that stops making it. Like, even with dopamine and norepinephrine, there's a feedback loop. As soon as it feels like it got what it needed, there's, you know, feedback that says don't make more. Serotonin, not so much. So we can actually really make this pathway go. The easiest things to do are to either take 5-HTP and 50 to 200 milligrams. I usually have people take it on an empty stomach in the morning. Or you can take tryptophan, 500 to 1500 milligrams. Tryptophan is incredibly helpful for sleep. It is my number one sleep aid. Number one sleep aid for all of you who need one, tryptophan. It's same thing. L-tryptophan is tryptophan. Theoretically, you could find tryptophan also in its other form, D-tryptophan, but I've never seen it. So if you get tryptophan, it's going to be L. Question back there?
Are these levels of tryptophan
So B vitamins, yes. Tryptophan, probably fine. When I have pregnant women in my practice who are on 5-HTP, see, 5-HTP is made inside the body. We don't normally eat it. Actually, how we get it in a pill is that it is extracted from a tree in Africa, but interestingly enough, whereas tryptophan itself is usually synthesized. But I move my pregnant women to tryptophan because I know we just eat it. So I feel like it's pretty darn safe, basically. But now let's remember, when we give natural products, just if I had more pathways sitting around to show you, you put something at the top of that pathway, but tryptophan, remember, it has a kidnap possibility. So if you had a lot of inflammation going on, that tryptophan might get kidnapped and go down an irritating pathway. Sometimes people take tryptophan, not commonly, this is not common at all, or 5-HTP, and it doesn't feel good. And if that happens, you should stop. I mean, I'm really talking about 5% of people, 1 in 20. But if it happens, you should just stop and maybe go back and look at, whoa, why is that happening? Question?
You said 5-HTP or
tryptophan. Yep.
So you should take one or the other?
I think you should start with one or the other. If you really wanted a little for, see, 5-HTP doesn't have so much sleepy with it.
Yeah.
And look, it bypasses a lot of steps. Because actually there's a few more things than iron that have to happen there. And as far as I can tell, you can't kidnap 5-HTP down that pathway. So I like 5-HTP a lot, unless the rare person who doesn't feel good on it, then maybe they'll feel great on tryptophan. I mean, it's just kind of a funny thing. But yeah, but so pick one or the other. I mean, overall, if you're going to do this based on this lecture, start with one of them at the lowest level, and then just kind of work into it.
When you say stop it, it doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that won't feel good? Is it your mental state or your GI tract?
You might. Well, people who are inflammatory have a risk of more inflammation. 5-HTP, again, these are very small subtypes, can actually increase cortisol. So again, it's kind of another pathway. So I have it happen rarely, but every now and then somebody will come in and go, I tried it, I didn't like it. You know, I go, okay, well, why don't we have you go stop, try it one more time, make sure you just weren't having a bad day. Because people I deal with, they feel good and bad all over the place. You know, just to try and make sure that's really it, and then let's try something else. The other thing is that sometimes you don't have the cofactors in place. If you've got enough vitamin B6, SP5P, or enough iron, you're fine, you're flowing. But sometimes you just don't have those pathways moving. Yeah?
Is there a reason not to go straight to the melatonin for sleep?
No, I think melatonin's great for sleep. And we'll talk about it later in dosages, actually. And combining them's great. I mean, honestly, the thing is you're going to get real bona fide sleep. Like, I'm not really sure what ambient sleep is. I hope it's real sleep because a lot of people are getting it, you know. But I know that this is real sleep. You know, you get all the cycles, everything. Okay, last question, maybe.
What's your idea on taking amino acids down regulating the rate of production of them, specifically with regards to
It won't.
Could you repeat the question?
I'll tell you why. Now, some of them it could. But thank you. The question is, what about taking amino acids, particularly like 5-HTP, will it downregulate your body's production of them? Is that essentially what you're asking? The thing about it is that this cycle, like I said, doesn't have a negative feedback loop to it. So that's not really going to happen. Now, let's be clear. This is a treatment, not a cure. If you have low amounts of tryptophan, or for some reason you need more serotonin because you're stressed out, you're going to take 5-HTP or tryptophan, and that's going to work while you're taking it. And when you stop taking it, you won't have cured your problem particularly. For that, maybe you got to help your gut, get your husband to stop yelling at you, you know, start dancing, whatever. But, you know, but it's not really an issue there. And I haven't seen it be an issue either. I mean, honestly, I hope the 5-HT factory doesn't go out of business because I'd have to be half out of business. I have so many people taking some 5-HTP or tryptophan because it's so nice. Even if they're not, like, depressed, just that it's just nice. I feel like it's good overall. So my point is you could feel a little dump if you decide to go off it. But that dump will probably not be worse than how you felt at the beginning. Okay?
5-HTP. You recommend taking it on an empty stomach in the morning, if you're taking something else like thyroid, or something that you have to have on an empty stomach as well, is it?
It's pretty okay with thyroid. Thyroid's always a question. They want you to have thyroid really on an empty stomach, but this will be fine. The thyroid thing is really around minerals and big bulks of food. It won't matter. Yeah, I do it all the time. I have people do it all the time. Every now and then there's somebody that takes 5-HTP and it upsets their stomach, and then they have to take it with a little food, and that's okay. This will still work with food. You'll just get a little bit more if you do it on an empty stomach. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about something I have not heard anybody go ahead and do. So I used to always say, okay, if you're on a serotonin uptake inhibitor, don't take 5-HTP unless you go and see somebody. And I'm going to actually kind of riskily but carefully consider that that might be not necessary to be so overly careful. So remember, serotonin goes out into the synapse and it either is reuptaked, I'm sure that's not the right way to say it, or it is degraded by an enzyme. By the way, that enzyme is called monoamine oxidase, MAO. So an old kind of antidepressant was an MAO inhibitor. It prevented the breakdown, had a lot of other problems. Evidently, they've got them now that don't have the problems. But okay, so if you guys maybe have known someone or been someone who was taking Prozac or Zoloft or, you know, grandson of Zoloft or whatever, who it worked really well for the first 6 months or year, and then they felt like it just stopped working. So one, this is a theory. This is, I've heard people say it, I don't have any data on it at all, but that over time what's happening is because you're preventing the reuptake. So these neurotransmitters, serotonin we're speaking about now, is spending more time in the synapse available for being degraded. So you're getting more degrading, and over time you're actually decreasing the available serotonin. So you're doing the uptake inhibition, but there's not enough serotonin to do it on over time. So what's interesting, and I've certainly done this a bunch of times, is that if you want to take a little risk here, you could try adding just a little teeny bit of 5-HTP, because you're going to start to feed the number of molecules at the top. And like I said, I've done this so many times, you know, where we don't want to rock the boat. The person doesn't want to go off their SSRI, at least not first thing. And so that SSRI stays in place, but the person is not feeling well. And we just add a little bit at the top of the channel, and it suddenly that SSRI just comes alive again. So the big thing here is that you've got to be careful with it, because there is the possibility of so-called serotonin syndrome, where you're actually having too much serotonin. So if you're going to do this, start with 5-HTP, or even do half a pill just to make sure for a couple days, and just see what happens. If it feels bad, stop. Okay, I'm going to... Okay, St. John's wort, really quick. St. John's wort does a million things, not a million, but probably 20 in terms of how it works. It is an uptake inhibitor of serotonin, probably also dopamine and norepinephrine. Mild MAO inhibitor, whole bunch of other things. If the drug companies could make it, they would. 300 milligrams three times a day. Again, you could combine that with your 5-HTP. There are actually a number of formulas out there, Happy Brain formula, that will combine it. You probably need a little less if you're combining. The downside and why people started to not take St. John's wort anymore is that it does, maybe because it's actually upregulating some detox pathways, I don't really know why, but it does make some other medications move through too quickly, particularly the protease inhibitors for HIV. So anybody on HIV, absolutely, I mean on the protease inhibitors, can absolutely not do St. John's wort. There's a possible concern about birth control pills. It's pretty unproven. You really can't find the documentation, but there was a concern there. So another area to be careful. Okay. So now, number... Okay, we're... Last one.
What about SAMe?
Oh, SAMe. You know, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it. SAMe increases methylation. If you take it, make sure you're taking enough folic acid and B12. And that's all I'm going to say about it, because otherwise I'm drowning in lack of time. All right. All right. So GABA glutamic acid. GABA is the true and major inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain. Xanax, Valium, they are all working on GABA. Glutamic acid, stimulating. Very stimulating, very necessary. Too much GABA, monosodium glutamate. The word glutamate is exactly the same word as glutamic acid. Anything that has an ic acid at the end gets abbreviated as an 8-glutamic acid is glutamate. So if you have too much monosodium glutamate, that's too much glutamic acid. So high glutamic acid and low GABA are associated with a lot of icky things. Anxiety, depression, bipolar depression, migraines, seizures, Parkinson's disease, schizophrenia, lots of things have too much of that. And again, overall, most of us want to cool it down. Also, high glutamic acid just can cause a lot of neurodegeneration. So it's really not something we want from the point of view of having a healthy brain at age 80. Let me run through these slides on this and then see if you still have a question, okay? Okay, so now I'm going to do things that can tilt this balance. There are a lot of ways to either increase GABA or decrease glutamic acid. And a lot of time we're not actually like increasing or decreasing the amount of the neurotransmitter, but we're increasing or decreasing their effectiveness, basically. How you know, how well they get into the nerve or how well they bind to the membrane. So that's how this works a lot. Okay, so like, so first of all, magnesium. This is going back to how much magnesium to take. See here, I'm say 400 to 1,000 milligrams of magnesium. I think magnesium is a gem of a mineral. I mean, it is great. It really can help with that GABA glutamic acid balance. A lot of studies, migraine, seizures, preeclampsia, which is seizures in, well, a lot of other things, but when a pregnancy gets into trouble. Now, some of these studies have been on IV magnesium because it can be hard to get enough magnesium in your body, certainly in an emergency situation, but very nice. I think doing higher magnesium is really great, helps people sleep. One of the issues with magnesium, good and bad, is that most forms of magnesium have a laxative effect. So it's my number one laxative. So I give people magnesium citrate who are constipated. It's great. They're getting magnesium and their bowels moving better. The form called magnesium glycinate is the one that is the least likely to be a laxative. So if you tend to already be a little bit on the loose end, that's what you want to take. And you can get that in different places.
Is there too much magnesium?
Wow, it's really hard. Honestly, I mean, theoretically, there's too much of everything. I love magnesium, and I myself, well, for instance, I actually get IV magnesium pretty frequently, and it just is great for me. I mean, it settles down a whole kind of musculoskeletal trip that I can get into, and, you know, I have it available to me because of my work situation.
Are there ways to test for your magnesium levels?
Yeah, and again, even if you could get your normal doctor to do it, he could do it. What you really want to do, magnesium is inside the cell, so you want to test for it in the red blood cell, not in the plasma.
So would that be a blood test?
Yep, blood test. Yeah, that's probably the only relevant way you're going to get it. But you can just take more. Another way I didn't put on this slide that you can get magnesium that really bypasses the issue of your digestive tract is Epsom salt baths. And they're great, nice warm bath. You have to use at least half of the container. Don't put 2 tablespoons in, that's nothing. You take that container and throw in half of it. And ooh, very nice, very, very nice. Probably not as good as an IV, but very nice. Okay, nobody's gonna go get their IV like I do. I just walk across the hall, it's easy. Okay, now here's a really interesting thing about these. Glutamic acid, big excitatory neurotransmitter, GABA. Inhibitory neurotransmitter. Isn't it interesting? GABA is made from glutamic acid. It's a pathway. That's how we get to GABA from glutamic acid. And here's the interesting thing. That is made by an enzyme called glutamic acid decarboxylase, which, by the way, when I was a high school student, I worked in a neurochemistry lab, and I was studying glutamic acid decarboxylase in cockroaches. So very exciting piece of my history. But anyway, it turns out that the key nutrient important for that reaction is vitamin B6, in the form called P5P, pyridoxal 5-phosphate, which you'll notice also was way back important in making serotonin. So P5P is a great thing to take. 50 milligrams, empty stomach. Thing about it is that I would say 10% at least of people do get a little queasy from it on an empty stomach, but it is much, it's absorbed much better on an empty stomach. So, you know, just see if you can. B6 is often depleted by birth control pills. So when you have yourself or your daughter starts taking birth control pills, even though you didn't want them to, and they start to get kind of moody, well, they're also moody, but let's just say it seems that it really had to do with the birth control pill this time. You can try some vitamin B6 as P5P.
And that's just B6?
Yes, it's the active form of B6.
P5P.
Yep. See, here's the thing about these vitamins. You know, you think vitamin B6, but really vitamin B6 is a family of vitamins, same as folic acid. And here's the funny part is that a lot of the time, and this has happened with many, many different nutrients, when they first were becoming known, they picked a kind that would be then put in most of the vitamins. So pyridoxine is what is in almost all the vitamins. Now, a lot of people convert really well from pyridoxine to P5P, which is the way it works in the body, but a lot of people don't. So then you want to take it as P5P.
Can you buy it that way?
Oh, yeah, totally. P5P. That's right. You're going to have a lot of letters here, 5-HTP, P5P, all very confusing. I actually still do, looking for an empty stomach time, you know, in a world of lots of food and vitamins, I take some vitamins when I wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, if in fact I do that. And one thing I've been doing forever that way is P5P. I don't really think about it as a sleep aid, but what I noticed in the days when, you know, I've had a little insomnia in my life, if I take P5P, it takes about an hour for it to kick in. But at that hour point, and even that would be the only thing I'm taking, I just feel this wave of relaxation go through my body, and I just drift off to sleep. It's associated definitely with remembering your dreams more. So one of the things I used to say is if you're not remembering your dreams, try some P5P. Now, I'm a super sensitive person. Don't expect to feel that. I always tell my stories, and people go, I took that. I didn't notice anything. You know, but you might. Okay, taurine. Taurine is an amino acid. It binds the GABA receptor, thus stimulating GABA-like activity. It also stimulates enzymes that build GABA and inhibits the ones that break it down. It's very benign. It's often depleted in breastfeeding. I think all breastfeeding women should take 1,000 milligrams of taurine. To be actually therapeutic with taurine, meaning to take it and feel a difference, unless you're really deficient, you probably have to take more than 1,000. Now, I don't really know what that number is, 2,000, 3,000. It's not going to hurt you one way or the other. It doesn't actually compete with any other amino acids, so there's not really a problem there. Okay, so here we are with melatonin. Melatonin actually blocks the main glutamate receptor, so isn't that interesting? In addition to, you know, being a metabolite of, you know, serotonin, dark light state, so many things that it does, melatonin, very nice for sleep. I recommend it as a sublingual, meaning it dissolves under the tongue. And the reason I recommend that is that it goes in faster, basically. You don't have to think about what you ate before, when you're taking it. It kind of probably takes about a half an hour to work. So if you want it to help you for going to sleep, then take it then. I have not found a preparation that lasts you through the night. If you're a middle of the night waker-upper, I think tryptophan's your winner. And if it's a really serious deal that you wake up and you just don't go back to sleep, pop a melatonin at that point. Melatonin is involved with the dark light cycle, so if you wake up, you took melatonin, you feel, oh my God, shouldn't have done that. You know, get up, get in the light, and take the shower. And for the most part, you'll kick it out, which is kind of nice. You have to see how you are on that. But, you know, for me, I think sleep is super important. Sleep is, what do you know? It's on the slide. Perhaps the most restorative activity for the brain. It may be the most anti-inflammatory activity for the brain. If I'm looking at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm thinking, I'm going to take something, it'll be natural, but I'm going to be more groggy in the morning. Am I going to take the sleep or the grog? I'll always take the sleep with the grog. You know, I'd rather fight through it for a little bit in the morning and get my sleep. Everybody doesn't feel that way, but I do. Okay, what else we got here? Theanine. Theanine is not like an amino acid that we normally have in our bodies, but it is an amino acid-like supplement. And it's antagonistic to glutamic acid, meaning it works against it. In Japan, they put it in their soft drinks and their chewing gum, so I figure it's pretty safe. I think that's kind of a commentary on Japan versus the U.S. The U.S., we got caffeine in everything. Japan, theanine. All right. So 100 to 200 milligrams a day is a nice dose. Okay, so GABA. Why don't we just take GABA? Theoretically, GABA doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, but it does. It does for a lot of people. That may be because they have a leaky brain barrier. I think that's probably part of the story. Or there just may be other ways that it manages to get through. There are actually some studies, though, on GABA taken itself reducing anxiety. So I think it's clear that it does do that. And, you know, again, these are doses. Start with 250, go up to 750. I mean, my upper ends aren't things that you absolutely cannot go beyond. They're just kind of conservative upper end doses.
Does GABA affect your cognitive abilities at all?
You mean in a bad way? Because it's... These products all are different. Like, to actually take GABA, I don't know, that might make you a little bit more kind of over-relaxed, but probably none of these things are going to. B6 is not going to. Theanine actually has a little effect also on dopamine or norepinephrine. That's one of the things about theanine. It's supposed to be alert relaxation, although people can take it for sleep. You know, except kind of ODing and being groggy in the morning, most of these will not affect your cognition, but they could. You know, everybody's different. I have people call me because they didn't like the vitamin C, so I've seen it all. Anything could do anything to anybody is my rule. Yeah, back over there.
I'm sure it's too much to go into here, but on your website, you go into options where you don't want to actually have to take pills to get it from food sources for any of these minerals and amino acids.
Well, I like pills. I mean, seriously. Well, so the way to get amino acids is protein and a fantastic digestive system. So, and you can get a lot of the minerals and vitamins, obviously, from fruit and vegetables. And, you know, obviously there are details of exactly where you would get them. But if you're looking for a therapeutic dose, you'll have a hard time getting it from food. So again, if you're, like for instance, tryptophan, everybody says, oh, it's in turkey, great, forget it. They are sleepy at Thanksgiving, we were talking about this earlier, it has nothing to do with the turkey, it's the fat and the in-laws and, you know, the wine and all of that. Of course you'd be tired after all of that. But it's because in turkey, you have tryptophan, but you have all the other neurotransmitters and amino acids that are competing for entry to the brain. So these things are really therapeutic things that I'm putting up here, and I think it's honestly, you get therapy from food, but not in this way. Okay, then we got to run.
I was going to wait to the end to ask you this, but since you said you like pills, I thought I'd ask you now, would you be willing to share with us how many pills you take? And I have a concern about this, and that is for a lot of these ingredients, they're only made in one or two places in the world, and many of them come from China. What is the potential downside of exposing ourselves to something that's completely unregulated? You only know what's in that bottle because it says so on the label. There's no testing. It's not like a pharmaceutical where it's actual, you know,
right.
Someone says, if you test this, we know there's this much in here.
Right.
So, first, how many of those do you take a day?
I don't know. Maybe 20. Maybe a little more. Something like that.
Not 100?
No, I don't do 100. Well, if we all took all of them, maybe. But we're not going to all take all of them, probably. Because we've got some that are making us up and some that are making us down. Again, I think that's where quality comes in. I mean, the companies that I personally deal with, I know they assay their pills, you know, because I can get their assays. And, you know, I know that I can get their purity statements. You know, there was a point where I did this on all of the fish oil. I just got everybody's purity statement, third-party tested or in-house tested. You know, I mean, I think that there are a lot of concerns, but... Overall, again, I just think that there's more benefit than downside. I mean, there's downside to a lot of stuff, but if we can get people out of depression with 5-HTP instead of with Prozac, I'm going there, you know? So that's kind of, I don't want to have a long talk about it because it just takes too long to get into all of that, but there we go. Okay. So we already did this. Yes, GABA. Okay, real quick for the ladies. Progesterone is a GABA stimulator. So progesterone is an option in terms of a hormone. You can get it at your friendly health food store. It's a cream. There's really nothing negative associated with progesterone. Women who are menstruating can do it for the last half of their cycle. Actually, as women approach menopause, they stop ovulating before they stop menstruating, and a lot of times they'll end up having too high of estrogen relative to progesterone, and they'll start to move into some insomnia. And you could try progesterone for that. I don't use it a lot, actually, but it is an option, and it is, I think, a very safe one, actually. So here's a review. I won't re-go over them all. I put tryptophan down at the bottom, just or in 5-HTP, because it does regulate GABA. I didn't mention it in this group. I mentioned it before. All right. Now, in my theoretical 8 minutes remaining, enhance excitatory neurotransmitters. Honestly, I think most of us don't need to do that, so it probably won't take more than 8 minutes. Actually, we do. Okay, I'm going to jump to the next one and then come back to this, because that's how I'm used to doing it. So dopamine and norepinephrine, two very wonderful neurotransmitters. Dopamine, you know, really helps people be focused, be on task. These are very complicated neurotransmitters. I'm not going to do them justice here. But both of them, stimulating, alert, I'm happy and I'm energized. Basically, you make these again through amino acids, but there are feedback mechanisms here. And so I do see excellent results with these, but probably not as mind-blowing as I do with the serotonin pathway. And it's hard. The pathway goes, there are two amino acids. Phenylalanine goes to tyrosine. It's all there. You don't have to remember it. You can take either one. It doesn't matter. and then you need iron to make that jump from phenylalanine to tyrosine. You need that wonderful P5P to make the jump from tyrosine to dopamine. And then dopamine converts into norepinephrine. It's kind of hard to control where it's going to stop. You're going to get more dopamine. You're going to get more norepinephrine. Actually has a little bit to do with the copper-zinc balance, so good to have. You always want more zinc than copper, like by several times, if not 10 times. But they both are important there, basically. One thing about tyrosine is it also helps build thyroid hormone. So when you take tyrosine, you feel energized, could be doing a number of different things. And that usually is only going to really happen if you're low, in terms of the thyroid hit, if you're low tyrosine. But I do see people who have low thyroid and who are also low in tyrosine. You give them tyrosine, and their thyroid gets more normal. Thyroid, you've probably heard people say, or maybe you've heard T3 and T4, the two different thyroid hormones. The T is tyrosine. The 3 and the 4, by the way, are iodine. So that's how we measure those. But anyway, so an option for increasing these neurotransmitters is just to take 500 to 1,000 of either phenylalanine or tyrosine. This is definitely empty stomach, and I virtually never see it upset anybody's stomach in the morning. Also, the P5P can be helpful. Iron, if you need it. Okay, so the thing I always want to say about this is, in general, I start people with the serotonin end, because we need some regulation before we start to throw in these. These are actually pretty strong things to do, by the way. They're not, so I say, this is not vitamin C. This is definitely, you're going to have an impact. 5-HTP is not vitamin C either. I mean, these are ways that are therapeutic, that you're really going to affect your neurotransmitters. So flipping back a slide.
If you're using a salt that's not iodine, do you have to have iodine in your diet?
We all need some iodine. So if you are having uniodized salt, you could try a kelp tablet. I have had people that started kelp, and it just made an incredible difference in how they felt. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on with iodine right now. There are some people that are giving super heavy doses, which would make the endocrinologist completely freak out, because iodine has always been looked at high doses suppressing thyroid. You know, there's a whole complication there. But at least to be getting the daily value, which is 150 micrograms, I think. Okay. Yeah? We're going to get to acetylcholine. Okay, let's just hang on 1 minute for that. Okay, so another interesting way that you can deal with not only bringing up dopamine and norepinephrine, but that is just an incredible therapy, amino acid-wise, is doing an amino acid mix. And so what you're looking for here is a balanced amino acid mix. And I actually mentioned these in that little slide about what you can find on my website. I have two different ones. One's called BAM, Balanced Amino Acid Mix. And then there's one that's called All Basic Plus. Okay, so these are, in one case, all of the essential amino acids. In the other case, kind of all of the amino acids. And both of those formulas do have tryptophan in them. All of these formulas used to not have tryptophan in them. What a great way to induce a tryptophan deficiency. But now they all have them. But you have to watch. A lot of them on the market don't. But if you take these things 30 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes before breakfast in the morning, you're looking at 3 grams to 10 grams. Basically, very temporarily, for an hour or two, it really brings up your amino acids. Then it kind of just goes back down to normal. This has an incredible effect on fatigue. And even people with chronic fatigue, you know, really chronic fatigue, it's a great treatment. And, you know, if you are fatigued, it's worth a go. Maybe get a little bit of the serotonin going first and just give it a try, basically. The one downside that I've seen from, besides all of these stimulating things, balanced amino acid mix, tyrosine, phenylalanine, obvious downside is jittery. People who are already a little jittery, they're tired, but they're kind of jittery. Chinese medicine, we call that yin deficient heat, kind of a deficient excitation. Don't go here. You really do not need more excitement. Even if you're tired, you need to first cool it out so that you're not jittery anymore. And then maybe, just a little teeny bit of these things, but not very much. But this could be just a great treatment for people. And almost all of these mixes have quite a lot of like tyrosine and phenylalanine in them. So you get that handled with this kind of a mix. Okay, here we are in acetylcholine. So acetylcholine is a real learning neurotransmitter. Okay, so there are a number of different things that you can do, and they actually kind of work out for people very differently. A lot of the kind of risk around acetylcholine is, again, too much stimulation. But phosphatidylserine, which is part of the membrane of the neuron, and it enhances acetylcholine release, also settles down that important stress pathway, the HPA axis. So for a lot of people who want to have more brain memory function but not get jacked up, phosphatidylserine can be your winner. And it's a great thing to try. There's a lot of studies showing, particularly cognitive decline with aging, that you take your 50-year-old who's starting to forget names and forget why they got to the room to get the scissors or whatever, and turn them back about 10 years. So more phosphatidylserine has more studies with that kind of cognitive decline than it does, say, with Alzheimer's disease. But definitely great for memory. Acetyl-L-carnitine, these are the two in this group that I've used the most. More stimulating. It enhances acetylcholine. This has had quite a number of studies on decreasing the decline, like if you give it to people at the early stage of Alzheimer's, really slowing down the decline. Also just good for memory. Alpha-GPC is, now see, like lecithin gives us choline. Eggs give us choline. These are general ways to get it, but we now have people giving us choline and kind of designer choline. And this kind of really gets a lot of choline so that we can make acetylcholine after it. And same thing here, but now interesting with alpha-GPC, which I have not personally used enough with enough patients to really say it, but it also stimulates the release of GABA. So, you know, again, you're not wanting to go too far in that stimulating end. This could be a winner for you. And, you know, actually, some good studies on this for memory, stroke, Alzheimer's, and vascular dementia. In Europe, it's a prescription. It's kind of interesting the things in different places that are prescription and the things here that are prescription that are not anywhere else. Okay. Okay, here's a real fun one. No, I'll get your question. Huperzine A. Huperzine A is made from Chinese club moss, which is an old Chinese herb. Believe me, this stuff is extracted and lots of little things done with it. But
Again, in some countries, this is a prescription, and it actually is an Alzheimer's medication. They're using a little higher doses, maybe, but what it is an uptake inhibitor. So it doesn't let the acetylcholine recycle, so you're getting more in the synapse. I have seen side effects with it, even though you read every study you read says no side effects. But I've seen people like get migraine headaches or something because it's very stimulating. But also love it, but have to stop it because of the side effects. But it's an option. Let's see. I think we're... Oh, here's our bonus. Okay, so that was it on stimulating. You had a question. You still have that question?
Oh, yes. I just wondered if you had heard of a supplement called Juvenile. Get it back to the
acetyl-L?
Acetyl-L.
I think that is the acetyl-carnitine with lipoic acid combo.
Right.
And they're both great for this. And Bruce Ames is really super, super, super smart guy. Smarter and more knowledgeable than me. And really, and I think it's probably, again, it's just a combo of a couple of things here. One more question?
Yeah, a follow-up on that is, I've heard that acetyl-L and alpha-lipoic acid are great for cellular health.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely there are things I'm not even talking about here. I'm not talking very much about antioxidant at all. A lot of these things do a lot of other things for you, either directly or indirectly, and acetyl-L-carnitine definitely does. Acetyl-L-carnitine helps the body burn fat in the mitochondria. So carnitine itself is something that, where people are really stalled in weight loss, that I'll throw some of it in, basically. So it just does a lot of things. Okay? Acetyl has an acetyl group on it. It looks like acetyl is taken in more easily to the brain, but honestly, everybody that I actually have a conversation with about, it's probably individual differences. Probably all of them work, basically. But acetyl-L-carnitine is the one that has the research on it in the brain, so that's why I present it here, basically. There's even some other forms, too. Okay, last question and then quick hormones. Yes?
I'm feeling a little overwhelmed with a long list of things you're recommending. Is there some basic package that you recommend?
Yes. So first of all, remember, so it turns out my big four for everyone. Multivitamin, with all the things I said. Vitamin D, unless you have enough vitamin D, you've been tested for it. Fish oil. And a probiotic. So I tell you, that'd be incredible. And then the rest is really quite targeted experimentation. Do you want to see what happens if you get a little more serotonin? Do you want to see what happens if you get a little more GABA? Or, you want to play with, kind of brain stimulation, basically. But that foundation, in many ways, that's why even though it's boring, it's arguably really important because you can see these cofactors, the B6 in your multi, it's going to hit your brain neurotransmitters in 20 places instead of just one. So I do think I have too big of a list here, but so I'll just quickly add to that. Okay. I'm not going to have brands here. Again, look at my website if you want to. That's all the stuff I use. A lot of the stuff I use won't be sold in the health food store is the problem. You can get it from me if you want. But you can also just look around for comparable. And I do agree with you about, quality is definitely an issue, which is kind of interesting, but okay. One, that's it. You haven't asked a question. You win.
A question about with vitamins and some minerals, the absorption, is it better to take them in two doses? Like I've heard, like with calcium, 600 is at a time, twice a day,
yep,
instead of the whole. And with vitamin D also.
I have not heard that about vitamin D at all. Nor have I seen that. I think it's probably fine. The biggest place where that makes a big difference is calcium, magnesium. You're trying to get a lot of it in. It's a big mineral. You'll just overload the little transport mechanisms, But getting it is better than not getting it. So if you have to just take it all at once, then maybe you should take a little less because you probably won't get it all anyway. Okay, real quick on hormones. Number one, thyroid is a huge issue in depression. I just make a little note here. TSH is a main way of measuring it. TSH is thyroid stimulating hormone. That means it's saying make more thyroid. That means when it's high, your thyroid is low. You want your TSH to be for sure under 3.
The lab tests in your doctor will probably allow 4 or 5, but if you're tired and depressed and you're 3 or even 2.8, see if you can shake someone up. We'll help you with a little thyroid or look at it in some way. 2, estrogen does a lot of good things for a woman's brain. It improves mood, improves memory. There's actually good studies on dementia. Again, the risk of breast cancer, obviously there is going to be that one woman in 1,000 that it's a loser. Overall, it's incredible. And you know, even the really basic studies on overall life extension that have been concerned, probably overly concerned with breast cancer, have still come through that overall women's lives are extended by estrogen. The three things that I'd say about it are always doing a light dose, always doing it through the skin. Through the skin bypasses a huge amount of problem related to stroke, and always bioidentical. We don't want to do the horse stuff, the stuff that's bioidentical for the horse or a synthetic. So I can't talk any more about it, but I can just say that it's a big player. Unfortunately for most of us, the clear data will be in 50 to 100 years. So right now we're an experimental group one way or the other. We're either doing it or not, basically, but either one is an experiment. If you've been in menopause and off it for 10 or 15 years, probably not worth it to go to it, basically. But if you're just at that time and you're thinking about it, I guess what I'm just saying is just really look at all the information and just don't just be afraid of it, because it has so much benefit. All right, I am done. Only 7 minutes over. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. So we're going to have a break, and everybody knows where the bathrooms are. Snacks are back there. We do have some chocolate-covered almonds just for a break. Oh, 15 minutes only. Right. Roadrunner.
Yes. Just absolutely great. I'm looking at the fireplace.
All right.
And I'm going to call you and see if I can make it.